So we're talking about prayer this summer, and just by way of launching into what I want to say to you this morning, I need to confess I've never found it easy to pray. Maybe you have, but I haven't. I remember the first prayer that I was ever taught by my mom. When we were very, very small, it went something like this. It was a crazy, weird prayer. It was, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake," what kind of encouragement is that for a kid? I mean, really. We were messed with from our youth. But we prayed that every night. I didn't know any better. When I got out of those years and began to go to junior high and high school and become a young adult, I really didn't know how to pray. My prayers revolved around three words. The first word was sorry. I had to pray that a lot in high school. I won't go into all the details, but there were things and there were words that would pop out. The S word was beginning to pop out all the time. And I said, "Sorry, God, sorry, God, sorry, God." Came to Alberta and found out if you were a farmer, it wasn't a swear word. But anyway, where I grew up, it was. The other word that shaped my prayers was the word help. I didn't know how else to say it, but sometimes I'd just say help. And the third word was thank you. I didn't know what more to say than sorry, help, and thank you. And I would listen to people that would pray for 15 minutes, some of them half an hour. Some people would say they would pray for an hour. I knew people that spent a day in prayer. I had no idea, still don't sometimes, what they do. Because I haven't been able to do that real well. I have friends that come from a different perspective, and I love them dearly. They love Jesus. Spirit people, I call them. And when they pray in such a loud voice with such strange language. I have no idea where they're coming from either. My prayers have been, sorry, help, thank you. And when God asked me to be a pastor, I thought, why would you call somebody to be a pastor? And when it comes to prayer, all they can say is sorry, help, thank you. But he did. So that's what you got stuck with, I guess. But I don't think I'm the only one that finds it hard to pray. Is there anybody here that finds it hard to pray, to fill up the time? A few people. Two things have helped me over the years. One is this. I remember one time when I came into God's presence, and it's like he stopped me and said, "Before you say something, I want to say something to you." And what he said to me was this, "Dan, I just love to be in your presence." And it stopped me in my tracks, and I thought, God, that's backwards. It's me that is honored to be in your presence. But he said it again. He said, "I love to be in your presence." And it reshaped my world because I came to the understanding that God likes our company. He really does. And prayer is an invitation to spend time with him. And not only should we like his company, but he actually loves to spend time in our company. You know, as I become a grandfather, and I am, I'm learning more about God than when I had kids. When I had kids, I learned a lot about God, and you will too. But when you become a grandfather or a grandmother, you learn more about God. You know what I'm learning about God? A couple weeks ago, we're in Chilliwack, and I'm walking around with my little grandson, Rain. And the thought struck me, I just love to be with this kid. And if a week goes by and I'm not with that kid, there's something wrong. I love to be with him. And I remember the Lord saying, Dan, you love to be with him, and all you're doing is walking around with some kid that hasn't done anything, good or bad, really. He hasn't graduated. He doesn't make any money. He's not an athlete. But everything in me is drawn just to spend time with him because of who he is. He's Rain. He's my grandson. God said, you know, when you come into my presence, sometimes you don't think you're worthy. Sometimes you think you haven't done enough. Sometimes you think I'm like this, what have you done now? But I just love to be with you because you're you. That's really helped me when it's come to pray. The other thing that's really helped me is a whole book in the Bible called Psalms, because the Psalms were written to teach us how to pray. And I want to take you there again today. I took you to one last week, Psalm 51. I'm going to take you to another one today. Most of the Bible speaks to us. What the Psalms do is they speak for us. In other words, when it comes to filling out sorry, help, and thank you, the Psalms put the words around those three words. The Psalms give you the words to speak to God. And I don't think that we're supposed to go around inventing all our prayers. I think they've been given to us and we can pray them. I think that's how Jesus did it. I listened to him at the deepest crisis of his life, hanging on a cross, and he's praying to God at the most desperate moment of his life. And what does he do? Does he dream up words? No. He takes Psalm 22 and he prays it to the Father. I think that's the way we're to pray. So I'm taking you to three Psalms these 3 weeks just to show you how it should work and maybe help you bring your prayer life up one more level. If you took the book of Psalms and you read it, there's 150 of them, you'd find quite quickly that there's different types of Psalms. There's, for example, Psalms of confession. So when I have sinned, dropped the ball, messed up, those Psalms are there for me to pray in order to fill out the word sorry. When I'm ecstatic with how God has worked in my life or answered my prayer, there's Psalms of thanksgiving that tell me how I could articulate that praise and thanksgiving to God. We'll look at one next week. Another category of Psalms is called lament, lament Psalms. And I want to take you to one of those today, but before we do, let me tell you a little bit about this category of Psalm called lament. They are the polar opposite of the songs of prayer and of thanksgiving and praise. When you're praying and you're thanking God and praising him, you're at a really, really high level. But the Psalms of lament, they take you right down to the bottom when you're at the bottom of the pit. About a third of the Psalms are Psalms of lament. And you can see on the screen the characteristics of Psalms of lament. Most of them are structured this way. They start by saying something like this: things are not the way they're supposed to be. And then they move to, yeah, but it doesn't have to be this way. And then the psalmist calls out to God to change the situation. And usually there's a statement at the end where he says that only God can change the situation that I find myself in. That's a general structure for these psalms called the Psalms of Lament. They're a cry when a person is in great distress, where he's nowhere to turn but God. Maybe troubled by their own thoughts, maybe by the actions of others or enemies. Maybe frustrated by God himself, or maybe sick, or maybe overcome by some of his own temptations. But these Psalms of Lament are a cry when a person is in great distress, and they will teach you how to pray when you're in trouble. So let me take you to Psalm 3, and I think it's a typical Psalm of Lament. Starts with a heading, which is part of inspired scripture, a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. And then that strange expression, Selah. Nobody knows what that means, but it probably was a musical expression because most of these were put to music, and it may have meant pause. And maybe the idea was just take a pause here and reflect on just what's gone on. But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill, Selah. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God, strike all my enemies on the jaw, break the teeth of the wicked, from the Lord comes deliverance, and may your blessing be on your people. That's Psalm 3. It actually shares a very close relationship with Psalm 4. Both of them have to do with the king, and the king's in a lot of trouble, surrounded by his enemies. And if you read them, you discover that his landscape was in disarray in both Psalms. But his soulscape, if you could put it that way, his inside was in order because he was a man of faith. Psalm 3 has often been used as a morning prayer and Psalm 4 as an evening prayer. But I want to work through it just using that outline I showed you of a lament psalm. And I think when we work through it, you'll get some indication as to how God would have us pray when we're in trouble, to fill out the word help. So you remember the first thing about a lament song was that psalm, rather, was that things are not the way they were supposed to be. In other words, life is not right. It's not the way God promised it to be. You get that in Psalm 3 right from the heading, where he says a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. Things were not right in David's family. Absalom was his son, and David is fleeing for his life from his own son Absalom. You can get the story behind the psalm in 2 Samuel 15, 16, 17. Seems that a lot of the nation had rallied around Absalom, and David had to flee Jerusalem to escape his own son. It's enough to say that David's family at this point was in turmoil. Another way of saying that would be David was a parent in pain. Life was not the way it was supposed to be in David's home. It was not what God had promised, not what David had looked forward to. It wasn't right. And maybe you can relate to that. Maybe you have kids, and you started with the promises of God, and so you dedicated them to Jesus, and you prayed that God would raise them up to know him and pour his spirit out on them, and that God would do wonderful things with them, but somehow everything's gone sideways, and so have they, and it's not right. It's not what God has promised. It's not what you expected. And you, like David, find your family in turmoil. Maybe it's your marriage where you both made vows and you committed to stay together for the rest of your life and you trusted each other, but one of the two has proved untrustworthy and one of the partners has left and you're the one that's holding the bag and it's not right. It's not the way it was supposed to be. Or maybe it's a different set of circumstances. Maybe you've been falsely accused of something by someone, or you've been overlooked for a promotion, or you've worked hard, but you have no results, or you're trying to live for God, but your temptations are about to take you out, and life is not the way it's supposed to be. That's the setting for a psalm of lament. And whatever your circumstance, I think there's times when you can relate to what David says. How many are my foes? How many rise up against me? In fact, David says, there's many people saying, God will not deliver you, David, and you have to understand that this was painful, a very painful and personal taunt that was thrown at David. It came with this on it. David, your family would not be such a mess if you hadn't messed up yourself. Because Absalom's rebellion was probably the result of David's sin with Bathsheba. It was Ahithophel who could never forgive David, who with Bathsheba's grandfather, who then counseled Absalom to be treacherous to David. And people were saying, David, you're reaping what you've sown. You can't expect God to deliver you when you messed up and you're just getting what you've sown. You ever felt that way? You ever looked at your family and said, you know, if I'd been a better husband, better father, it would have turned out better. Or if I lived for God the way I should, then all this stuff in my life wouldn't happen. Satan loves to do that. Many are saying of me, David said, God won't deliver you. It was very personal, and it was very painful for David to hear. But I want to say something to you. David could pray this prayer in spite of the mess he'd made of his life for one reason. That reason is articulated in Psalm 130 in one line, and it's this line, but with you, God, there is forgiveness. When God forgives a person's sin, he clears the slate. And he doesn't count that against you. And it's proper and right, even if your sin has led to consequences, to pray, God, in the midst of these consequences, deliver me. David understood that, and that's what he did. He starts by saying, oh, Lord. Those are the first two words out of his mouth. So it seems to me that when we're in trouble and we want to pray, the thing we have to learn to do is to turn to the Lord right away. Not second, not third, not at the very end, but I think we are encouraged by these Psalms of Lament, whatever distress we find ourselves in, to first turn to the Lord as just a matter of course. Well, if you take the second point in the Psalm of Lament, it's this: things don't have to stay the way they are. And you get that with that one word in verse 3, but you, Lord, are a shield around me. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. Seems to me that David is reminding himself of his relationship to God and what it means. God, you've promised, covenanted to be a shield around me. Therefore, this doesn't have to be the last word, this bit about Absalom and this rebellion, all of these enemies. God, you're the one who lifts up my head. And David had experienced that before. There was another time when David's head was bowed in shame when he had committed adultery with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah and been found out, his head was bowed in shame, but God lifted up his head. You ever found that about God? If I could take an aside for a minute from this and say to you this, when you fall into sin and you are so ashamed and you don't know how to come back, or if you can come back, there will be voices that talk to you. Let me help you understand the way God works and the way the enemy works when your head is bowed in shame. When you have been overcome by your flesh, like David was, you will find the enemy come in like a flood and try and condemn you and push you down further and say, you are guilty, you've done it so many times, you're done. There's no hope. And there'll be that sense of condemnation and hopelessness with that voice. But you know what David found? That God is the lifter up of his head. Do you know what that means? When I tried to live like Jesus on occasion with my children, and I didn't do it enough, and they were overtaken with something they shouldn't have done, and I'll never forget the way Rick would come. He would stand like this, and he'd stand with his head down, and he'd be the picture of defeat. Discouragement was awful. And he was waiting for my lecture and for my rebuke. And if I wanted to act like Jesus, what I had to do is I had to get down because he wouldn't look at me. I had to get down on my knees. I had to lift up his head and I had to look him in the eyes and tell him, Rick, what you did was not right. And as a result of that, this is going to happen, but I need you to know that I still love you and I'm your dad and I will help you to do right. And when I got back up, inevitably, he was able to look me in the eyes. That's what Jesus does. He will get down in whatever pit you're in, at whatever level you've sunk to, and he will lift up your head and he will tell you the truth about what you've done and he'll say it wasn't right. But not in the sense of condemning you, but in the sense of you can do better. I paid for your sin, Dan, and I will help you walk different. And somehow he lifts up our head. And David had experienced that. And so on this occasion, he prays again, Lord, my head is covered with shame. And if you read the story in 2 Samuel 15, King David, when he fled from Jerusalem, his head was bowed down and his head was covered, a picture of a man on the run in despair, full of shame. And it's interesting because when he crossed the Jordan River, he's just called in the text David. But when Absalom's defeated and David comes back, the covering's gone, his head is held high, and when he crosses the Jordan, everybody calls him King David. It's incredible. It's like David recognizes that God always is a shield and bestows glory on him and lifts up his head. And in this prayer of lament, he prays, God, things are not what they are supposed to be, but he moves to that next point. But God, you've lifted up my head before. You've come through before. It doesn't have to stay this way. And I need to say this to you. When you pray, when you're confronted by life the way it's not supposed to be, never accept it. Never accept it. Never accept that that's the way it's supposed to be. It's not the way it's supposed to be. And you can go to the Father and you can say, look, you created these children. You brought them into the world for your honor. They're not the way they're supposed to be, and don't be content to leave it that way. Or when you're struggling with deep temptation and all the stuff that comes with that, you can pray, Father, you've given me a spirit of power. It's not the way it's supposed to be. I need help. Can I expand it to our vision to give life to Red Deer? I want to say this really clear, and I hope you get this. When you pick up a newspaper and you read that somebody in our city has been shot to death, murdered, what do you do? You say, that's incredible. We're getting like Calgary or Edmonton. And do you put the newspaper down and move on? Or do you put that paper down with anger and say, Father, this is not the way it's supposed to be. We're praying for this city. We're praying that God's kingdom come. God, this is absolutely unacceptable in Central Alberta. Is that the way you pray? I think that's the way we're supposed to pray. It's not acceptable that happens here. This is God's place. We're giving life. That's death. You cannot tolerate that kind of stuff when you pray the way David prayed. You have to pray, Lord, this is unacceptable. I hope you've prayed this week, Lord, would you give great wisdom and expertise to the detectives and the policemen that are trying to find the perpetrators of this crime so that they can be brought to justice and it can be stopped. I hope you pray that way. See, I think when we're trying to learn how to pray and we follow the psalmist, he looks at life, whether it's his personal life or a wider world, and he says, life isn't right. But he doesn't stop there where most of us do. He moves to the next point, but this isn't the way it's supposed to be. And he talks to God about that. But then he goes to that third step. He actually calls out to God for help. So life isn't right. He recognizes this isn't the way it's supposed to be. So what does he do? He cries out to God. He says in verse 4, to the Lord I cry aloud. In other words, the cry is a strong word. It means to draw attention to yourself. God, there's a sense of urgency and passion here. I need you. I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. You know what's interesting about that to me? If you were to ask the question, so where was David when he prayed that? You know where he was? He was in the Jordanian Rift, which is probably the lowest point on the planet, almost 1,400 feet below sea level. So he's as far down as you can get, but he's praying to as high as you can get, the center of the universe. And it's an incredible picture of this fact, that no matter how low you've sunk or how far away you feel, when you cry aloud to the Lord, you are instantly heard at the center of the universe. It's a tremendous picture, verse 4. And then he says, I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. Now that is an expression of trust. In other words, what happens here is he takes this mess that he finds himself in and he says, Lord, help! And then he trusts God. And he demonstrates his trust by going to bed and sleeping. There will come a time in your prayers and in mine when we need to trust God. There are times when God calls us to let go of what's troubling us and finally to trust him. Let me share a personal bit with you, and I dropped something I need. But earlier, I think I told you last week, we were doing a wedding in Las Vegas, and it was a wonderful occasion, and I love weddings. But something troubled me, and that was the wealth of the people that I was with, we were with. They were hockey players, and they had a lot of money. And the fault really wasn't theirs, it was mine. What happens when I'm around people like that is it does something to my heart, and I want it too. There were times when I thought, why can't I make $5 million a year like them? If I could do that, I would pay off all my kids' mortgages. It played in my head something crazy. One night, they all went out for dinner, and we were doing something else. In fact, we weren't even invited, but they all went out for dinner. And the bill came to $6,500. You know how they paid for the thing? There was a bowl in the middle of the table, and everybody making $5 million or more a year put their credit card in. There must have been 5 or 6 credit cards there. The last one pulled, paid the bill. I thought, I'd love to have been there and thrown in the church credit card. Said, yeah, things are good in my world too, you know. And I just wanted to do that and then pray like crazy it's not pulled last, I guess. But about that time, I pulled out a book I'd taken along, which was the polar opposite of that. And it was called The Hole, H-O-L-E, in Our Gospel, by a man named Richard Stearns. Now, Richard Stearns is about my age. He was a CEO of a very important, significant company in Philadelphia, making a lot of money, having lots of opportunity, Christian, but fully engaged in his world. And then God began to talk to him about leaving his work and becoming the CEO of World Vision US for a whole lot less prestige and money. It took 2 years for him to wrestle this through. Finally, he went kicking and screaming to World Vision. Now, the hole in our gospel is a book about the character of our God. And his point is that most of us in North America have this God that wants to make us and keep us comfortable. But the God of the Bible is the God of the oppressed and a God who wants justice for all. A God who challenges us to share what we have with those that don't have. And he says we've neglected that part of God. Well, I have never been impacted by a book in years like I've been impacted by that book. I wrote more notes in the back of that book than any book I've ever read. And I think that it's probably changing my life more than any other book I've read in a long time. But I say all of that to bring you to this quote, where he was called, like David, to let go of the things that were troubling him and to trust God. And he had to demonstrate that, like David did, by sleeping. Let me read you a bit from his book. He says, in 1987, the largest single-day stock market crash since 1929 took place. In one day, Renee and I lost more than one-third of our life savings and the money we'd put aside for our kids' college education. I was horrified and became like a man obsessed, each night working past midnight, analyzing on spreadsheets all that we had lost, and the next day calling in orders to sell our remaining stocks and mutual funds to prevent future losses. Of course, that turned out to be the absolute worst thing I could have done. I was consumed with anguish over our lost money, and it showed. One night when I was burning the midnight oil, Renee came and sat beside me. "Honey," she said, "this thing is consuming you in an unhealthy way. It's only money. We have our marriage, our health, our friends, our children, our good income, so much to be thankful for. You need to let go of this and trust God." Then he says, "Don't you hate it when someone crashes your pity party?" I didn't want to let go of it, and I told her that I felt responsible for our family and that she didn't understand it was my job to take care of things like this. She suggested we stop and pray about it, something that hadn't occurred to me. Remember I told you the first thing in a crisis is to pray? It hadn't even occurred to this guy. So we prayed. At the end of my prayer, to my bewilderment, Renee said, "Now I think we need to get out the checkbook and write some big checks to our church and the ministries we support. We need to show God that we know this is his money, not ours." I was absolutely flabbergasted at the audacity of her suggestion, but in my heart, I knew she was right. So that night, we wrote some sizable checks, put them in envelopes addressed to various ministries, and sealed them. And that's when I felt the wave of relief. We had broken the spell that money had cast over me. It freed me from the worries that had consumed me. I actually felt reckless and giddy. God, please catch us, because we just took a crazy leap of faith. And you know what? God caught us. See, whether it's Richard Stearns or whether it's King David, you cry out to God for help, but there's a point where you have to trust him. And when David trusted him, something else happened. I think this, that his faith was built, because he then says, "I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up on me on every side." Isn't that incredible? It's like before he was afraid of a few foes, he's prayed, he trusts God. It's like God builds his faith and David says, "You know, I can take on the whole world." That's really what he's saying. And I love what John Calvin wrote about this. Do you know what he said? He said, "Let us learn when in dangers not to measure the assistance of God after the manner of men." That's a great quote. Let us learn when in dangers not to measure the assistance of God after the manner of men. God is not a man. He's not limited the way we are. He's not limited by the enemies and the foes that surround us. That's what Calvin's saying. So if I could quickly jump to the last thing about a prayer lament, if I could remember what the first three were, I would tell you. The first one was things aren't right. Second one is, but it doesn't have to be this way. The third one was something to the effect that, so I'm going to call to God and ask for help. Fourth one is this, that only God can change things. And you see, I think, that statement at the end of this Psalm of Lament, where David says, "Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance." See, you know what he's saying? He's saying, "God, if you don't bring me deliverance, it isn't going to happen." And that's true. It's true of all of us. If God doesn't step in and do God's stuff, we are going nowhere and nothing's going to change. But I think it's very important to say at this point, and I need you to get this. that prayer is not opposed to the proper use of means. For example, if you read the story behind Psalm 3, you'll get a fuller picture than you get in Psalm 3. In Psalm 3, you get this picture of David surrounded by enemies. So what does he do? He calls out to God. He goes to bed and he trusts God in all as well. But if you read the story, you'll find out that David is surrounded by enemies. He prays. He goes to bed. But he also devises a strategy. He brings in somebody to frustrate the counsel that Absalom's getting. And he sets up a bunch of messengers from Jerusalem out to where he is back and forth. In other words, David prays, but he also devises a strategy. And to say that God alone brings deliverance does not mean that we cannot use the means that are in front of us and that God doesn't use those means. He does. I think David remembered when he was confronted by Goliath as a youth. He prayed, he trusted God, but he also armed himself with a sling and 5 stones. Seems to me that it takes more faith to risk the surgeon's scalpel than to simply lie in bed and pray, God, heal me. There's a lot of people that just pray, God, heal me. And if he does, great. But sometimes he uses the surgeon's scalpel. And I think it takes more faith to go under the knife than it does simply to lie in bed and say, God, heal me. So there's the proper use of means, and David's trust in God, and God somehow honored both and delivered David. And I think that's an important point to make when you're working through a psalm of lament like this. Let me just say a couple things and I'm done. All that's well and good, and all that's helpful to know when I'm trying to fill out the prayer help. But a psalm of lament, I think, can be used in a broader, deeper, richer way than that. See, we ought to pray for ourselves, but I think we ought to be praying on behalf of people in our world who are in deep, deep distress. And you can use a psalm of lament to do that. I don't think there's any of us here today, there shouldn't be any of us here today, that aren't aware that while we sit here in a beautiful building, going to a meal after this, that there's roughly 2 million children in Somalia who are starving to death and may live or die, depending on whether aid gets through. Does that ever break your heart? We sang, break my heart for the things that break your heart. You know what you should do with a psalm of lament? You should have it in one hand, and you should have the newspaper in the other hand. And when you read or hear about the people of Somalia, what you should do is open your Bible to Psalm 3. You should place it on the floor and you should lie down and you should cry from the bottom of your heart for those children. You should pray, Lord, look at those 2 million children that are starving to death. And look at how many are their foes. How many armed men rise up against them to prevent the aid from getting to where it should get. Lord, there's many people saying around me that what we do can make no difference. There's lots of people in our world, Lord, saying you won't deliver them. But Lord, remember who you are. You created these children. You formed them. You called them by name. You know every hair on their head, and it matters to you whether they live or die. And we ought to pour out our hearts, and we ought to pray and cry over that. We ought to cry out to the Lord, knowing that he hears, that he answers from his holy hill. A psalm of lament can be used that way. It's for you, but it's for you to use on behalf of other people too, and I hope you use it that way. I'm deeply disturbed at me for my lack of brokenness over the brokenness in the world. And if God doesn't break my heart in a new, fresh way, I'm done. I am. I do not want to do what I do if God cannot break my heart for the people of the world. And I hope you're done playing games too. I hope we can take this stuff and we can lie in front of God and say, God, would you hear my cry for the people that matter to you? You know, we are so consumed by our stuff, by our vacations, by our pleasures, by all of this stuff, and very seldom do we weep for the things that break the heart of God. I think a lament psalm pushes us in that direction. The last thing I'll say about this psalm, which is worth noting, is if you took it and you look back at it from the light of the New Testament, you might change the first 2 words in the psalm. And the words that David starts with are the words, O Lord. I think if I look back at it from the New Testament, I would say Father, because Jesus said you can now go to God with the word Father on your lips. That's the single most important word when it comes to prayer. Because when you say Father, you are reminding yourself of who you are. You are reminding yourself of who He is. And whenever you say Father, you know that any father with a pure father heart stops what he's doing and gives his child his full attention. Jesus said, when you pray, say Father. I understand, but it troubles me when Christians pray God. I know that God, any attempt to look in his direction gets his full attention. I get that. But it seems to me that when I say Father, I distinguish him from all other gods. If you just say God, most people can sign off on that. But when I say Father, that's different. When you pray Father, you have his full attention. And I think it's proper to insert the word Father, the beginning of this song, in the light of what we read in the New Testament. So let me ask you to stand. I'd like to pray with you and for you. And then Deb's going to come up with the team. And let's worship God with all of our heart one more time. Whether you can sing or not, whether you can clap and sing at the same time, let's just go for it. And know that he stops heaven to listen to people that love to be in his presence, because he loves to be in ours. Father, today it's amazing that we get to come into your presence. We don't understand it. We don't know why you care. We don't know why you don't wash your hands of us, but you haven't and you don't. And I know that your heart jumps every time we say, Father. Thank you for that. Thank you that you're concerned that we know how to approach you, and you've even given us the words to approach you with. Father, teach us to pray as we read these Psalms. And I pray, Father, that this week, even as we've sung and sing again, that you would begin to break our hearts for the things that break yours. Father, we waste so much of our life on things that ultimately don't matter. And on the other hand, you've given us everything good to enjoy, and that's a difficult road to walk. So would you give us wisdom in living life with all the abundance that we have? Father, would you teach us how to pray on behalf of other people? This morning, the things that are of your spirit, would you root in our hearts, and the things that aren't, would you blow away? For we pray in Jesus' name, amen.